I'm a man who believed that I died 20 years ago, and I live like a man who is dead already. I have no fear whatsoever of anybody or anything.
Gary Webb. I am an investigative journalist, and in 1996, I wrote a series of stories entitled Dark Alliance, which was about CIA involvement in drug trafficking.
I knew a man who once said death smiles at us all. All a man can do is smile back.
We've opened Skull and Bone, the secret society.
It's so secret we can't talk about it.
What does that mean for America? The conspiracy theorists are going to go on.
I'm sure they are. I don't know. I haven't seen the record.
Number 322?
I sad duty to report this afternoon that my friend and colleague, Tim Russert, collapsed and died early this afternoon.
I may die in this cell tonight or in the arena tomorrow. I am a slave. What possible difference can I make?
And no official of my administration, whether his rank is high or low, civilian or military, should interpret my words here tonight as an excuse to censor the news, to stifle dissent, to cover up our mistakes, or to withhold from the press and the public the facts they deserve to know.
Welcome to Already Dead, your weekly conspiracy variety call-in show. We're live, motherfuckers. I'm here with Austin, my co-host, and then Ken Silva, the kick-ass journalist. I just had him on about a week ago, but the episode dropped today for all you people who aren't patrons out there, where me and him interviewed an undercover FBI operative. He doesn't like the term informant. And he said a lot, so I think it warranted having a commentary. And besides, we've been looking for an excuse to bring Ken on. And also, we were actually originally supposed to talk about something different during that episode, and then this kind of fell in our lap. So we'll probably talk about another story as well. Ken has covered many stories that I've had him on the show many times. So a lot of stories that I've been drawn to. I know Austin feels the same. This is Austin and Ken's first meeting, I believe. So that's kind of cute. But yeah, Austin is a big fan of Ken's work as well. Yeah. But so it's cool to have you here. I don't know, Ken, if you want to, maybe you want to give like a quick summary of who and like what our interview was last night. Maybe you can give a better summation of it. Just kind of quick rundown for those who didn't watch it. But I would suggest you go watch it. It's out. Go check out the Rumble. The Rumble version has the sweet edit that Lainey made for me on it. I wasn't able to make it work because of copyright issues on YouTube, and then I don't know, I just couldn't figure out how to set it up on MP3, so I just went the... But Rumble's got this dope edit, so go check out that one. But anyways, Ken, what the fuck did we do? That was bizarre. Part of why I wanted to talk to you is because I kind of want to, I don't know, talk about what the fuck we did, because that was kind of nuts.
Yeah, it was crazy. I'm still trying to process it all. For people who aren't familiar, I've done a series, an investigative series called The Fed Files, which looks at the FBI's infiltration of the neo-Nazi movement in the 2000s. A lot of people know about Oklahoma City, Ruby Ridge, but 2000s is kind of like nobody's written about it at all. So that's kind of what I'm trying to do. And one of the few primary sources is a book called Undercover Nazi, which was written by the former FBI informant, that's what the FBI would call him. He objects to that, but David Gledy, he wrote a book about infiltrating right-wing groups, and he was able to do that because his cover was blown in open court. So I guess that kind of freed him up from certain gag orders that the FBI had on him. And basically, he doesn't mince words. He admits to entrapping Nazis, and he basically says Nazis are bad people, so they don't have the same rights. I guess that's who decides that. I don't know, but David feels pretty strongly about it. I appreciate his honesty. And I guess the last thing I'll say is, like, I'm sure this is a libertarian show. A lot of people will object. To defend David, like, any country needs young, testosterone-filled kids that will do what they're told. Like, that's, if he was in the 40s, he probably would have been storming Normandy. He was in the 90s, so he's working for a corrupt government, not asking questions. I think that covers Glennie pretty well. I did interview him privately, just over the phone, and he told me pretty much the same thing he told me on your show. And I'm just like, oh, Jose has got to have this guy on. People have to see. It's one thing to read his quotes, but if you actually see him say it, that's just a different psychological thing. And mm-hmm. I think it's going to blow up on Twitter eventually. It's still pretty early. But yeah, so thank you for obliging my, you know, last minute audible. Yeah. And I hope, you know, it was well worth it, I think, for you and your subscribers.
Oh, I think so as well. By the way, I will be adding that to the, I think I already did, to the Fed Files playlist that I have set up for, because I think we did two episodes prior on your Fed Files, and then this, because I just feel like it kind of makes sense to add it to it. I might add this episode as well, just because we'll probably touch on a lot of the same stuff. But it was something else. I mean, we mostly just let him talk, and obviously I have my thoughts on it. Well, it is kind of kind of wild, him being completely unashamed, but then also seemingly... It's weird. I don't know. I guess to me, I just felt like a little bit of cognitive dissonance at times where he would point out, like, for example, you brought up how, like, oh, the Nazis, you know, those guys, you know, they broke, they, you know, wanted to harm people, so they lose their rights, according to him. But then he would admit freely that, yeah, a lot of innocent people are going to get hurt in the process. And you're like, well, I mean, that therein lies the issue, kind of. But, you know, I don't know. At the end of the day, also, at the same time, though, it was hard not to love him. He's kind of... like, in a Trumpian type of way, it was very just, I don't know, I guess refreshing in the sense that he just, yep, this is what I did. Yep, this is what they told me to do. I'm glad I did it. And you're like, okay. Like, I don't know. I actually feel like I could really enjoy, you know, having a beer with this guy. I mean, I just probably wouldn't pick at certain things because we'd probably get into shouting matches. But I don't know. I guess maybe that's where I'm a little less autistic than some libertarians. If we're in a social setting, why would I pick at things we're going to argue about? Who gives a shit? Just, you know, move on with life. But yeah, no, it was a unique character. I was glad to be able to interview him. It's just wild. I don't know. What are your thoughts, Austin? Because there's so much in that interview. He just said it all. I don't really know what there is, like, commentary wise. And then I guess I just wanted to kind of let people know, like, just because we nodded along, I mean, I think my audience is smart in that. Don't take that as me agreeing. There was a lot of stuff that I was like, yeah, it's pretty fucked up. But, like, I'm just letting him talk, and I'm glad he did, because now we were able to document that. So,
and you know. I think it was very necessary to give someone like him a platform the way that you did, and to allow him because when you're kind of approaching it with the mentality that he seems to possess, as far as the way and I'm not trying to insult this man at all. But he's definitely, all I will say is he's very proud of what he's done. And that alone is like, I feel like a level of, you had to convince yourself of something, I would say in hindsight, because I think that really it was more of a window into the landscape of how these, I guess, they're really informants, but if you want to call it an operative, they're kind of used in that way, and they're definitely utilized by handlers who, you know, specifically steer them into certain positions, and especially if we're in regard to, like, what was he running, like a roller? What was it? The parlor that he was running. What was it called?
Roller derby thingy.
Roller derby. Yeah, that was seemingly a front operation, right? Yeah. Was that entirely purchased by the feds? We know.
So I listened back to the interview. Mm-hmm. I've read a lot, and I think he might have still been working for the IRS or sometime. I think he was talking about, like, big broadcast companies at the end of the year, they got to dump a lot of money or they're going to get hit with a big tax bill. So they dump it into, like, some show like the roller derby. And David, from what I understood, he's welcome to clarify, Because I consider him a valuable source.
Oh, definitely.
I'm not going to talk shit about the guy. But I think he was sent there ostensibly to potentially investigate money laundering in the television show. But he later realized that actually he was given an assignment to infiltrate right-wing groups, and it actually buttressed his cover.
Interesting.
Apparently this used to be big. Adam, our producer, I don't know if he's saying that this guy worked for Roller Jam. I doubt it. He was just, I think, using it as an example. He said it used to be on TNN in the late 90s. We used to get drunk and watch when he's in college. I think because he's a little bit older than me and you, Austin. Me and you, Austin, are what, like early 30s? I turned 33 in a few days. Yeah. So, he's five or six.
Roller Jam, I think we are talking about Roller Jam because it was on TNN Friday nights. Really? And I'm 35. It would come on right after ECW.
Everything's a lie. It's a fed up.
That is hilarious. Yeah,
don't tell me that ECW is a FBI front operation. That would break my heart.
Oh, my God. That honestly, though, I will say that just the way he was kind of brought into the landscape in general was strange. It makes sense that you would like some small criminal charge, possession, whatever it is. And then, I don't know. It seemed like he was implying that he got rolled over as some sort of, informant just with the local PD or something with the narcotics division or whatever. I don't know, because he had mentioned it was for weed that he had gotten arrested for.
I think that, real quick, I do want to say, I mean, Ken can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the way he made it sound to me is that he was saying essentially he got busted for weed, and I think, maybe I'm wrong, he snitched. And then that of then got him in with, I don't know if it was the cops or who.
Right.
And then he kind of then got into the IRS. And then later, he had that reputation of being able to work. So they kind of pass him off the FBI. So, because it is kind of weird, because he does make a distinction between informant and operative. And the distinction is whether you got brought in due to like crime or whatever. And now you're, so like, I know maybe it's being a little pedantic semantic, because it's like a tiny drug charge. But like I think that's where he makes the distinction, because later it was a separate thing that when he joined the FBI. It's not like they were lording that weed charge over his head.
No, and that's not what I was trying to imply. What I was
I just wanted to clarify that, because I was trying to separate that in my head too, because he's like, well, you got busted for weed charge. And so I had to like separate the two events in my head.
Right.
Sorry, go on.
I just wanted to mention that the fact that the Orange County Sheriff's Department introduced him to the IRS to be a civilian investigator, was that how he put it in context? And that alone was strange, the way that he was just kind of laying it out as far as laying the groundwork. But I don't know. It makes sense that all the different agencies work together in that way. But also, it's like, to be a criminal informant at a level of like having marijuana possession, and then to what level were you a criminal informant for the local PD to then be like suggested as you should be an investigator for the IRS, to then be sat down as like an FBI potential informant / operative, right?
That's a good point. I feel like there might be a chunk of history left out, but sorry, Ken.
It felt weird.
The reason the IRS was interested in using him, I don't know how he made the connection, but he was he had a tree trimming company, and so he had access to rich people's yards. So the rich people would hire him to go trim their trees, and then he'd be like, tallying how many boats they have or whatever, and whether they have hidden assets. So that's how he got involved. And I should have mentioned at the outset, I did catch him in a couple contradictions. I think he told us the honest version on this show, but in his book, he talks about encountering the crazy mountain man, who we'll talk about later, I'm sure, while whitewater rafting. The mountain man was talking about terrorism, and so Gleddy approached the FBI, and that's how the relationship started in the book, where I think we just got the real story on the show. So, yeah, viewers beware. I mean, he admitted it. He's a professional liar, but I think we could suss out the truth by triangulating certain things and, using our brains.
Oh, yeah. Definitely. I did.
That's a good.
Go ahead. So, go ahead.
I was going to say that's a good point because there's one story that I think, and it might even be maybe it didn't behoove us that it was right at the beginning that it came up because this might scare off some people. But the Satanism story, and don't get me wrong, me and Awesome have covered like SRA and stuff like that plenty on the show, and like satanic connections to like Fed, like intel operations and stuff. But I don't know. I just feel like I have my doubts of that. And as you said, he is a pay liar. So I do think like when you listen to an interview like this, you need to look at it through that lens. Now, I don't know why he would make up that or maybe stretch the truth or maybe he misinterpreted it. I don't know. Or maybe it's the God honest truth. I have no idea. It just seemed that one did seem a little outlandish to me, especially where he was kind of getting at how like the Christian identity folks and the Satanists were, you know, hanging out a bunch. And that to me either leans towards it's fake to some degree or there's such a level of Fed infiltration to the extent that it's essentially it's just a big LARP and it's like I'm the guy playing the Christian identity guy. I'm the guy playing the Satanist and we're working together on this thing. You know what I mean? So like what are your thoughts? Do you have anything to really I mean obviously I doubt there's anything out there corroborate one way or the other because I think that's the first time he's ever mentioned it. So I don't know, maybe something, I mean, I highly doubt there ever be anything to corroborate it. I don't know how you really could, but I mean, I just, thoughts on veracity of things he said in general and just, I guess maybe that, I don't know.
I could lay down a few facts and then Austin could give his thoughts, if that's okay. I mean, I don't want to take over the show, but I just want to, lay down the facts before we give our opinion, I guess. Totally. Cause he did have dealings with Joshua Caleb Sutter, who is a Satanist and runs a satanic publisher. He's an FBI informant. The Bureau subsidizes a satanic bookstore. I think most people are familiar with that story. And so I told him, like, oh, wow, you actually had contact with Joshua Caleb Sutter. Like, do you have any stories to tell us on the show? And then the next day he tells us about participating in a satanic ritual and eating a deer heart. So I think he might have just wanted to tell me a good story because I showed interest. If he has some kind of proof or could elaborate, I'd love to talk to him more.
Yeah. I mean, I hope he doesn't feel offended that we think he's a liar, but I mean, like, to be fair, I mean, he had said he was a liar. Once again, like I said, I mean, I'm not even necessarily, I mean, I do find a lot of things he did despicable, but like, he is a very interesting guy. I mean, I don't know, Austin, do you have any thoughts on the that component? Someone brought up in the chat that he was in the premiere of the episode earlier. He was bringing up, we were kind of talking in the chat about the idea of the Satanists and them mingling. He brought up that the Processed Church is Satan and Christian and Nazi all at once. I haven't really dug too much in the theology of Processed Church, although I know a lot of those things do get blended together. So yeah, and also he did bring up the heart eating thing. I don't know if either of you guys grew up in like hunting culture, but that's also like a hunting thing. So I mean, obviously it's more like a wives' tale where some people take it seriously, where it's like usually your first kill, you're supposed to take a bite out of the heart.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, it just that one did seem a little outlandish.
Usually not like a blood ritual sacrifice, though, right? Yeah. Like, and that was what I mean, of course that popped out to me immediately because just hearing him say that, and it was early on in the interview, but yeah, that's going to trigger my mind immediately just merely because of like all the different Gladio connections that I've tracked that seem to tie in with these Satanist groups that seem to operate within a doctrine that is very similar to that. And so all I was thinking was that it was possible, certainly possible, especially if you're running in these groups, because all the Gladio networks, they all ran drugs, they all ran guns. So if you're in the gun circuit, you could very easily run across Satanists. I mean, I think it's possible. You know, he's operating in the black market. You know, he's in the shadows, and so, as are the the criminal elements of the Satanist organization. So it wouldn't surprise me is all. But yeah, I wasn't like, I don't know. I was only hoping that maybe there was something additional there that you had asked or that maybe he had told you, but it's all good. But it does make sense as far as you had mentioned that. And so it was kind of in his mind already, in his subconscious, maybe even, I'm not sure, but the Myatt connection, again, freaked me out because the 09A, and I've read things that implicate Gladio with 09A as far as David Myatt being like a part of the original psychological operation working with British military intelligence, even, which if that's true, and again, this is speculation, I don't have any direct evidence of that, but I certainly wouldn't be surprised. So that did that did not shock me, but also coming from him in context in the interview, it was weird. It felt kind of weird. It didn't feel like something that it felt off. So I wouldn't put much into that as far as credibility. But again, I'm not trying to insult the guy. I just thought it was really extraordinary to just mention that kind of off the cuff, you know, but anyway, I don't know.
Yeah. I guess one of the probably the other major point that I think merits bringing up is he brought up the and this has been part of his lore already. This has been written on before we talked about this. The idea that he was the name on all the petitions for the rallies or whatever the hell they were running, the protests. And that's a kind of a big deal considering, you know, with a lot of the things we've seen between the, what was it, the Wolverine Watchmen thing up in Michigan, the I don't know if it was a city hall thing or what the fuck event it was, or protest. Then also we have Charlottesville, January 6th. So we've seen this methodology of, you know, is there feds here? Is there not? Are they manipulating events? And obviously there's usually this hide behind like, oh, well, they're here. But now to what extent are they influencing things? Usually it seems to be they try to not let it go as far as something like this, to where they're directly, literally the ones like putting it together. So that way, because that's kind of hard to argue that you aren't literally, I mean, I guess aside from saying it's an informant and he went off book or some shit. I guess also just your thoughts too, because I think lately there's been this thing, especially within the right, where lately, I don't know, there seemed to be, we were all in agreement making fun of like Patriot Front and these type of people as being like feds. And there seemed to be this movement lately. And I get it. That is also lazy to some extent because it's more complicated than that. But I think we've seen the swing go the other way, particularly in the right, where now they're all, it seems to be a lot of the same people that, especially the ones that, you know, probably a lot of them might even be, you know, kind of hip on things like OKC and are still, you know, kind of having the opposite take. So we're like, oh, this is a legit, you know, group of wholesome white men coming together to, and you guys just think everything is feds and that way no one can ever do anything in real life. And it's like, I mean, I get it. I get that take somewhat, but I think to some extent it's like you need to have a realistic view on things and realize, I mean, as Galletti said, if you have, and once again, he might be using a little hyperbole, but he said, if you're in a room of 10 people in some domestic group, right, 8 out of 10 of them probably feds. I just thoughts on that in general. I guess he just straight up admitted it. So we're more just giving commentary on these things. But I don't know. I just found it interesting that lately that's been kind of a push within the right. And this kind of directly contradicts that to like, no, look, and this was from like about a decade ago or so. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think you could take David Gletty's word, what he says about the FBI organizing those neo-Nazi rallies in the mid-2000s. You could take that to the bank. Mm-hmm. A lot of things clicked in place when he told that story, because mm-hmm. the neo-Nazi rally was ostensibly organized by the National Socialist Movement, NSM, headed by Jeff Scoop, the notorious FBI informant. Now he's getting paid by the DHS after he marched it. Charlottesville. And I was wondering like how Gletti got involved with them, and you know, what's the mechanisms of organizing a rally? He only met Jeff Scoop a couple times, and I've never been more convinced that the NSM was in a FBI front group for sure.
Ooh, hell yeah.
For sure. And the reason they needed Gletti to fill out the permits is because he was the only NSM affiliate who lived in Orlando. And there was a law that if you're going to hold a protest in the city, you know, the organization's got to have a member there. And this, like Bill White covers this extensively. If you go to, I think, Fed Files 4, he talks about the Toledo rally that Gletti told us about, where the NSM goes into Toledo, the police weren't prepared at all. They antagonize a bunch of black people, a riot starts, and the NSM loved that because, you know, all these crazy black people are, you know, attacking us, and they get all this attention, recruiting numbers go up. And the feds love it because they get overtime pay. They have informants with the left wingers. It's all, it's all a big scam. Whether that localized model translates to something bigger like January 6th is a whole nother question. Like, I don't think 2 + 2 = 4 when it comes to that. You can't just draw that conclusion. But as far as specifically Toledo, Orlando, and probably Charlottesville, I would venture to say we're wholly organized by the feds. And I know I'll probably get a lot of shit from the Charlottesville guys for saying that, but, you know, so be it.
Yeah, which I think just lends to the point. And I'm not even saying that groups like Patriot Front or that there aren't groups out there that aren't either legit or mostly legit. I just think when you're dealing with these sorts of movements, you need to have a clear-headed view on what it is. And I mean, I don't really know how to say it, but like, that's just literally like, this is what they do. They infiltrate these groups. Anything that gets a large enough mass, there's probably going to be people there. I guess between the two of you, we'll probably get to call-ins here in about 20-30 minutes for those looking forward to that. I guess any final thoughts between, I guess, either of you guys, if you have anything else you want to really talk about with that interview. I don't know if, Ken, there are any other specific angles that you found interesting. I know you've been digging all sorts of other angles, working on new Fed file stuff or something along those lines. So I don't know if there were any specific angles that we didn't touch on that you're really spurging on right now.
Yeah, there's a lot of angles. I mean, the sleeping with the fat chick.
Right. But
as it relates to like the Whitmer kidnap case, the most interesting thing I think about that was him talking about you go in the FBI field office and they interview you and they tell you, you know, everything by the books. But then you go out in the parking lot and they tell you get results by any means necessary. And I just can't help but think of the recent story The Intercept broke about Steve Robinson, the pedo FBI informant in the Whitmer case, who their audio was recently published where the FBI agent is telling him, like, bro, what are you doing? All this stuff, like, not doing what we told you. And that, yeah, I think that was staged now. I believe that's staged for sure.
Oh, 100%.
Wow. Yeah. I thought,
Real quick, he made it sound like anytime there was any sort of fuck up they did, like, because he even mentioned it in regards to like drug usage. I guess they almost had like you can a little, but not certain things or not this much or whatever. It seemed to be like whenever there was some sort of infringement on their part, they would pull him in and like on. It seems like they would have. It sounds like what he was saying is they would have these struggle sessions essentially, or just talking tos of like, you can't do that. And I'm sure these were all recorded. And then obviously I'm sure the same phenomenon likely may or may not happen to where they get pulled out of the side and like, okay, but like, mate, let's get shit done. Okay. So that way, if this ever blows up in their face, they have that. And in the eyes of the informant, they're just like, oh, like this is just like a dot your eyes, you know, like he even said they're the legal aspect of this. And you're like, yeah, legal, meaning like they're covering their ass to burn you if it comes down to it. So, I mean, I guess one way to look at it is, oh, they're the legal side. You're like, oh, well, not really. They're separating themselves so they have plausible deniability and they're setting you up as the fall guy.
To that point, he even mentioned being tagged as a hostile witness and not being able to testify, right? And so I thought I thought that was so interesting how he had mentioned if he's kind of paired with a clean operative, then that one operative remains clean so they can testify in court. And then he's able to kind of operate, you know, without a leash almost. Right. And I like that seemed interesting as far as the concept alone. You know what I mean?
There is a distinction with a difference when it comes to informant versus operative. I actually think I will respect that terminology because he literally said, you know, he only made a couple criminal cases his all 10 years. He converted dozens of informants though. That was his job, just to get in there and be a mole. Like, it was really, really crazy stuff. And I guess I would just finish off as it's really the tip of the iceberg as far as this story about PatCon continuing post 9/11. Once David Gleddy's cover gets blown, shit gets even crazier. And maybe I could come back in hopefully like a month or something and talk about that. But I'm writing a 3-part series called Inside Robert Mueller's Right Wing Terror Factory.
Oh my God.
And it's basically, this is the first Joint Terrorism Task Force right wing terrorism case in history, from what I understand. Like, they did a bunch of Muslim cases, and this was like a beta for doing it against the right wingers. And they set up a neo-Nazi motorcycle gang as a front group. And our friend Joshua, not our friend, the fucking Satanist scumbag, Joshua Caleb Sutter, is involved with this motorcycle front group. So I'm telling you, like, this is, it's PatCon. It's PatCon all the way. And it's brand new stuff. And I just, like, thank you guys so much for giving me this platform, because, like, I don't have a big account. I'm kind of doing the work quietly, and you guys are really some of the only people that, you know, promote it. So thanks.
Oh, stop it, Ken. I feel like, I don't know, man. Like, the amount I've read your stuff and just, I look for your interviews and everything. Like, I mean, you are just an amazing resource at this moment in time. I think you're just so valuable. And I think just your ability to remain credible, you know, that alone is extremely valuable in today's landscape, and especially in the media, as far as, I mean.
Well, it depends who you ask, but I appreciate the kind words.
No, I'm just being honest, man. Like, when I found you, well, I think it was, I can't remember if it was the Stephen Paddock article or what it was that I found. I don't think that was it. I think I had just discovered you from either Jose or Scott Horton or something. I can't remember what it was, but yeah, just immediately when I found the Fed files and was reading through that, it resonated with me, because Waco, Ruby Ridge, OKC, that was such a red pill for me, you know, as far as lifting the veil as what government is capable of, what the intelligence agencies and these federal agencies are capable of, and really just in, I mean, self-interested ways as well. It's not always in the guise of like attempting to move forward. I mean, of course, you know, achieving some sort of totalitarian measure is a desire, but sometimes it's not the priority, right? And it's like, I just find everything that you're doing so valuable at this time. And it's just, I feel very grateful that I get to officially meet you. So thank you, man, for coming on the show in the first place. Honestly, dude. And I really appreciate the way you write as well. Like, I enjoy reading your work, and that always matters to me. But yeah, when I was reading through this, though, it's exactly like, you are I would think the most valuable resource as far as like trying to make a credible case that PatCon never ended. And that is just so important, right? That people don't forget, you know, that this, none of this stopped, right? It's the same thing we talk about when we talk about MKUltra and a lot of these other covert operations. It's like the implication, the public perception is that they all ended, right? With some sort of actual accountability, you know, that was brought forward by, you know, some sort of government mechanism, you know, right, the church committee hearings or whatever the case may be. And it's usually never the case. It's some sort of like controlled limited hangout that it will reveal certain information that's allowable for the public to it always seems like they're burying the most damning, the most condemning information that really needs to be brought to the surface. And that is what you're doing. And so I think that alone, thank you, brother. Right. I just have to say that. Honestly,
speaking of limited hangout, though, I do think I do like that you're taking the terror factor angle, but from the right wing, because with the limited hangout thing, I almost feel like, you know, whether this was contrived or just naturally happened by incentives, it seems like, I mean, anyone who's read Trevor Aronson's Terror Factory knows it lays out the case really well about all the follies of the informant system, But then it does this bizarre thing on the last chapter, which if you read the book, you know, it focused more on like the left wing Muslims, immigration, like war on terror type stuff. And then it kind of, and the last chapter has this weird conclusion when it kind of comes out, where he kind of points out like, well, we have this actual growing domestic terrorism issue. And I don't know if I don't recall, it's been a while since I've read it. I don't know if he outright calls for that being used, but it's almost implied that like, oh, this, what's being used for this could be used for that. And so it almost feels like there was this reflexive thing where they're like, oh, well, when they get sick of the infiltration on the left wing, we'll already have the infrastructure set up for the infiltration on the right wing. And then they'll probably over a course of 20, 30 years do the same thing all over again, be some other person. And luckily we'll have somebody like you writing this type of stuff that has the correct view. We were like, well, I don't like it when they do it to Antifa or any of these fuckers either. But who knows, in 20, 30 years, we could get the establishment version of these course of events. And then they frame it in the way of like, oh, well, we have this growing terrorism problem that this could be used for. So it's these subtle things that happens where people say the truth, but then they frame it in a way to get the desired reaction. And I'm not necessarily accusing Trevor Aronson of being an actual limited hangout, although I guess I have my suspicions, but
Trevor's the man.
I don't know. I just, that last chapter, I was like, come on. Like, how do you, but I don't know. Maybe he's just that die in the wool of a lefty. I don't know. That's why I said, whether it's by incentives or on purpose, either way, it's the same result.
I think Trevor's got a lot of integrity, and he's actually like giving me the time of day. And I know a lot of like reporters at the New York Times or The Intercept, they'll look at me, oh, low status, headline USA, right-wing guy, fuck off. But like, we've shared information, and like, he's a very, very good guy. He even gave me credit for breaking the story about Undercover Red being in Black Lives Matter and the militia trying to kidnap Whitmer. A New York Times reporter tried to claim credit for that. They even put it in their podcast, and Trevor called them out on it on Twitter. And he said, no, Ken Silva broke that. And so like, obviously I'm going to be biased in favor of a guy who gives me credit, but I think that also just shows his integrity. Mm-hmm. I would think that he kind of like, to get things published, you got to play the game. Yeah. And maybe he was trying to please his bosses, because in his own podcast about the infiltration of Black Lives Matter and the Whitmer plot, he's like, oh, because the feds were so concentrated on infiltrating Black Lives Matter, they missed January 6th. And I'm like, dude, you just like, you know, they had informants throughout the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys and everything. So I don't know why he would say something like that other than to appease his producers. But overall, like, he's one of the best reporters we've got. And I don't think we should attack the good ones. There's plenty of demons.
Yeah, this is why I've tried to make a point lately where I've said on a few different shows that limited hangouts aren't necessarily always a bad thing. And by the way, when I say limited hangout, I don't necessarily mean like whether it's intentionally or not, because once again, it's kind of the framing. And as I put there, you might be right. There might be things where it's like, I have to frame it in certain ways to be able to get this through my editors. And I do think there is something to, like, I've brought up the example of the most recent OKC documentary that came out. It was framed in certain ways to be a little bit of leftist bullshit in some ways, like kind of, you know, taking the, you know, almost the Tubin angle somewhat. But for the most part, it had a lot of great new information that came out. And so it's like, to me, I'm like, hey, I see that as a win. That's advancing the narrative in a positive direction. And I get it, sometimes to get through these establishment places, I guess you kind of maybe do need to give a little, or these are just the genuine beliefs of these people and whatever, that's just kind of where they're at in their journey and they might progress later. I mean, what with Trevor, who knows, maybe that was a book written a long time ago. I know he came a lot from the left, so maybe he's just, he's changed his perspective on things since he wrote Terror Factory. That always just sat me a little bit weird that would be the takeaway. But either way, I mostly just didn't focus on that. I'm like, other than that, this is a great book. It lays out the mechanisms of control, you know, that whether intentional or not, when it comes to the informant system. Now, I guess I did kind of want to maybe focus a little bit on the macro mechanisms of control. And this is getting very speculative. I'm not necessarily saying this is the case. But we've talked a lot about this in the show about how certain fronts sometimes the feds will work through fronts or through criminal fronts, and they use criminal operations to support their stuff. And I'm not even claiming this is a fed operation, but I do find it interesting that they, it seems to be your former employer, Epic Times, it seems like they've been accused by the Biden administration of being a criminal front. And it seems to be, from just perusing your article on it, seems to be they might have something here. So I just kind of your thoughts. And then I did want to like then kind of tie it in with how your time ended over there. We'll touch on that after that. But I just kind of like what let my audience know about what's going on with the Epic Times and that.
Oh, man, you guys throw me under the bus right after praising me? What's with that?
What?
Dude, you throw me under the bus saying I work for a criminal front? No, I just kidding.
Okay. I was like, what? No, I think you guys will see where we're coming from that. I don't know if you guys, maybe you guys aren't on the best terms anymore.
No, that's certainly not. Epic Times fired me. And they're like a nonprofit funded by a billionaire, right-wing, anti-communist Chinese person. And I was always looking at it from its cozy relationship with the State Department. Because the state, like you can see all this stuff about the genocide of Uyghurs. It's kind of like a tight relationship where the Epic Times amplifies that and the State Department's happy to feed them to it. And the Epic Times, our Twitter mutual Jim Carrison Keller, I think is his handle name. He's like a lefty, but he's a pretty good guy.
Yeah, he's good. He's good stuff.
He's a really nice guy. And he published documents showing, or an article showing, that the Epic Times gets State Department funding by way of the National Endowment for Democracy funding the Friends of Falun Gong, and then that goes to the Epic Times. So I've always looked at that angle, but apparently they were doing money laundering, and I have no idea why. I thought the billionaire was just funding it as a loss leader to get political influence, but apparently the DOJ is alleging that one of its executives was basically buying dirty money on the dark web, buying it at a discount, laundering it, and then putting it in the Epic Times bank accounts and representing it as donations. And I have no idea. I honestly don't know why they're doing this other than to present themselves as more grassroots and legitimate. We don't have enough details to know what's going on. It could have been one weird, ambitious executive that was trying to boost his numbers and make himself look good. I don't know what like Chinese culture is. If you're going to go into business just to if you're going to do crimes, just to like improve your reputation in the company instead of going into business yourself. But that's basically the gist of it. And yeah, it's hard to tell exactly what's going on.
Wow.
Yeah. Now I find it interesting to pair this with I don't know how to frame this because I forget what I can and can't say because you are currently under NDA, correct? You can confirm that. You're currently under NDA. But now I guess we can frame this in a way that you just so happened to be fired after you put out a story that then magically disappeared. And that story was about very much tied into, a story that I've talked about on the show, Oklahoma City bombing. And one of the characters, Dave Holloway, which was a buddy of Kirk Lyons, worked with him a lot in the Cause Foundation. I believe he was also Strassmeyer was with him in Texas at TLI. He also was the one that I believe escorted Strassmeyer out of the country. And essentially he was, you know, kind of the lore is like he was some sort of past Fed of some sort. And then working with the neo-Nazis. And then when it was all said and done, now somehow he has a job at NASA. Just bizarre. People can draw their own conclusions from that, you know, what they think. If you want to just maybe your thoughts on that story. Obviously, we're not saying any of these things are connected in any way, shape, or form. But that just so happened to be that was your last story at the Epic Times. And it disappeared pretty shortly after. I believe Arthur Bloom wrote a good story on it for those who want to check it out. So
yeah, I just put the link in the chat. Where to start? So I guess we should give Boltzmann Booty credit for discovering Dave Holloway working at NASA. Dave Holloway just put it on his LinkedIn. It seems like, I don't know, sounds kind of like David Gleddy, to be frank, where he wants to just brag. He like listed that he worked for Intermountain Aviation in the 80s, which is like a CIA front company connected to Iran-Contra, like just in the guy's LinkedIn. crazy shit. So Boltzmann Booty publishes that. And I'm like, well, shit, like this is newsworthy. I'm going to actually do some gumshoe reporting, call up NASA, call up some people and, you know, confirm this and do a story. And so I confirmed that Dave Holloway works for, man, Jacobs Engineering or something. I could, it's in the piece. And Jacobs Engineering is a NASA contractor. So Dave Holloway, he has to have a security clearance to have that job. How does he get a security clearance when he used to be in a militia that was investigated by PatCon? It's a very weird question. And then if you dig further into the piece, there's FBI 302s where Holloway is talking about having foreknowledge of the bombing. I mean, this is the guy who was talking to McVeigh on the phone, I think like the day or two days before the attack. And yeah, that guy holds a security clearance. I guess he checks out according to the fucking FBI or whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, though, that story. So I published that story and it got shared 4 times. So it's not covered by my NDA, but then it got spiked. I'm not satisfied with the explanation for why it was spiked. I can't really go into what I was told or anything, other than to say, like, it's all factual and truthful information. And I've since built on it. I just haven't published anything because I don't really know what to do with this work. I'm trying to kind of pass it off to my fellow exile from the Epoch Times, Liam. So Jacobs Engineering, they told me that they were investigate this. And so I wanted to publish another story about the investigation, but was fired before I could do that. And now Jacobs Engineering won't answer my emails, even though they promised to investigate this Nazi that's working for them. And I'm trying to give it to like a big high profile reporter that'll carry this story forward, because there's something going on here. I mean, I've tried to give this information to people in Congress, staffers, anybody. And like, I don't know if people just don't like to do complex storytelling, like reading that kind of journalism, if there's too much going on with Trump. But yeah, we have, I think you could reasonably say, somebody connected to the Oklahoma City bombing that currently works as a NASA contractor.
Mm-hmm. Hell yeah. And to summarize for the audience, because I know we're throwing a lot at you and you may not have followed all these stories. I guess to summarize, you wrote this story about someone who was in kind of in league with a lot of the players that seem to be involved in the Oklahoma City bombing. And now he's working for NASA. And you wrote this story and you then lost your job shortly after by a company that may or may not be a criminal front. So I just, the only point I'm getting at here is just kind of think about how certain mechanisms are put in place and how they operate. I'm not saying that this was some Fed operation to shut old Ken down, but if it was, would it look any different? You know what I mean? That's kind of the point. Like, so I think people need to be aware of how these things move and how it operates. So
yeah, and that's not the only story. It's in Arthur Bloom's article. I broke a story about Ehud Barak being a shadow investor in this spyware company that's selling products to local police. And I did that. I got company beneficial ownership records in the UK showing that Barak was still an investor. And they told me they needed to lawyer it. And they eventually published it, but they never put it on their homepage. And the story's still live. It's probably linked somewhere in his blog. But you'll see it's gotten like 2 shares to this day. And it's been up for like 3 years at the Epoch Times. So that's just one more example.
All right. Well, I think now we're going to go over to the call-in portion of the show. So you guys can call in with the number that I'm about to put up, 941-281-5857. And if you want to call and talk to us, also, if you're patrons of me or Austin, there's a StreamYard link in there that you guys can go get on. You can be a talking head on here with us. Also, if you want, you can just ask questions that you think are appropriate for our guests or us in the chat, and I will bring it up. I mean, I don't know if there's anything else you guys, like any thoughts you have on all this, Austin, in the meantime, while I scroll through the chat?
Well, the Epoch Times, it reminds me, as far as like the Uyghur genocide and the Falun Gong stuff, it immediately I think of Pat McFarlane, and I love his work on kind of exposing how that was almost like, and I'm not saying that there's absolutely no, you know, sort of harassment happening with the Uyghurs. That's not what I'm saying, but I will say that it seems to be sort of a manufactured narrative in a way that, as far as the West perception. And it seems like there is at the very least, a hidden hand involved with the idea that I know there's somewhat credible evidence pointing to the idea that that the CIA had like been kind of radicalizing and training certain aspects of certain Uyghur Muslims to then send them across the border and to cause domestic chaos, basically, right? Some sort of and so I just found that to be very interesting, because what do you do if you're if you're trying to protect? And again, I oppose government philosophically, so I'm not trying to like introduce the idea of like using the state as a tool, but I am suggesting the idea as far as the government reaction clearly will be, right? They're going to attempt to crack down on this group, which are the Uyghur Muslims that were being utilized. So, of course, I would imagine they were being, you know, at least abused in some fashion as far as their civil rights or whatever are concerned in domestic China. But yeah, I just find that entire subject matter interesting. But I always remembered that the Epoch Times, I'm sorry, and had connections to the Falun Gong, and that they had direct connections to this sort of manufactured narrative that was happening. So I'm not entirely certain of the details, but I always found it interesting. And I think that that connection alone suggests like that at the very least, you're propping up a false narrative in many ways. And everyone was suggesting genocide whenever that was hitting as far as that wave was crashing through the media cycle. So, I don't know. I think that many of these narratives are kind of propped up just to achieve certain goals. So it's just the game that they play. But so I'm not suggesting that I guess it means anything necessarily that the Epoch Times would have participated in that. But I do find it strange at the very least. And of course, it, in my opinion, with like the OKC ties, as far as I'm immediately reminded of Trinidad, Jesse Trinidad, kind of exposing the sensitive informant program. And I remember when I found out about that, man, like, and as far as my knowledge of the Mockingbird media and they, you know, the CIA basically infiltrating and institutionalizing, right? Like farming out media operatives to then infiltrate publications, but for the sensitive informant program to actually have a manual, right? And then wasn't Jesse the one responsible for getting the manual released, even though it's heavily redacted? Hasn't it been released at this point?
Well, I don't want to keep the callers waiting too long. I think it'll take like 10 minutes to explain. I will say that to Epoch Times' credit, they actually did publish a story I did on Jesse Trinidad's sensitive informant program. I think it's the actually only story in the world about Jesse's findings of that program. So it was a battle to get that published too, but they did publish it. I got to give them credit.
I mean, we got time if there's anything specifically you want to go in there. Although in the meantime, I do have in the chat, this is one of my newer patrons, so I'm going to bring his up, give you a little prioritization. You missed the last few shows, want to throw some of the Fauci stuff recently. Is it in the country's best interest to find him guilty of anything concerning the lab leak? Would that open us up to being tried by the rest of the world for damages? I mean, I don't really know if everyone's doing it. I don't really know how you litigate that. I don't really know. I mean, I know this isn't really your area, Ken, but I'm just bringing this up. But I don't know. I don't think anything monetarily will come out of this. Maybe people who have been, you know, vaccine damaged or something. Maybe. I don't fucking know. Have you guys any thoughts on that? I think it's in the best interest that it gets exposed. Now, so far as like monetary, obviously that all comes out of tax money, so I don't know how that works out, if that'd really be in the best interest of trying to litigate that, you know, nation and globally, that might be a fucking nightmare situation.
But, yeah. Well, my sources tell me that Dr. Fauci has already been hung at Guantanamo Bay. So rest easy, Patriots.
Yeah.
No, that's obviously a QAnon joke in case I get like shadow banned for that or something.
Patriots in control, baby.
Yeah.
But any thoughts on the informant program? You know, you brought up that, I don't know if there's anything specifically you want to touch on that between all of you. Can go as long as you want.
So Jesse never got the handbook, and the handbook kind of outlines not necessarily tactics, but it's actually more like restrictions on using sensitive informants. So that's kind of like I'm not saying like I disagree with Jesse, but when I really dug into it, I think that's more like what it is. But like the thing is that the manual itself proves that there is like a specific program for infiltrating Congress, the news, church, in sensitive institutions like that. And I guess I would just connect it to the recent controversy over the authorization to use deadly force in the Mar-a-Lago raid against Donald Trump. Julie Kelly, she broke that story. That it was like it was in the search warrant application that they have authorization, if necessary, to use deadly force. And now all these former so-called FBI whistleblowers are downplaying that, saying that, oh, it's standard operating procedure. In any search warrant, you're going to find that. And my question would be, well, let's take a look at Jesse's sensitive informant program manual. Maybe they have the answer that Julie and the feds have been arguing about on Twitter about whether you will be authorized to use deadly force against anybody, or if it's going to be a different situation when it's a sensitive investigation.
All right. Got another chat here from Dr. Corbeau's Feel Good Fun Time Medicine Show. But being as I live only about 35 minutes from Elohim City, I can say satanic, white, nationalist, Christian ones, and even the pagan ones all end up mingling, I'm assuming. I guess maybe this might be a time for us to exposit a little bit on Elohim City. Also, I don't know. I feel like I vaguely recall something along those lines about these type of groups mingling. So maybe I spoke a little too soon earlier, although maybe I'm just misremembering. I do know one of the common things whenever I forget who the fucking leader was over Elohim City. I can't think of his name right now. Maybe Ken can recall offhand.
Robert Millar?
There you go, Millar. I should have known that. But I know Robert Millar, it seems like, or other people who apologize for that place will typically push back against people calling it a right-wing, neo-Nazi, white supremacist compound, or whatever words you want to throw at it, because they will usually say, oh, it's just kind of like we take all forms of people, although primarily they are like a religious group. So I guess it'd be kind of like the same, in a certain sense, in their eyes, the same idea as like, I don't know, if you've ever had like a Christian summer camp that you send your kids to that you don't necessarily have to be religious, but it's run by a religious group, is kind of maybe how they would frame it. To where it's like primarily, yes, this is a religious area, but we're kind of accept all wayward souls type deal. Do you recall, I guess just kind of like maybe let the audience know about what Elohim City is, and then just kind of like, I don't know, what are your thoughts about them mingling with different groups? I don't recall, I mean, I can't recall any specific situations like satanic type people mingling and pagans, but maybe there was something to that. I'm not sure.
Elohim City is where the Oklahoma City bombing was planned. But yes, Satanists, BX Becca's research goes into this a lot, where Satanists like to try to infiltrate different institutions and subvert them. And BX thinks that's what's going on. Well, that is what's going on in more recent history, where you have like Order of the Nine Angles infiltrating the Atomwaffen Division and turning it from like a neo-Nazi militia to like a batshit crazy neo-Nazi militia that's doing all kinds of glow ops. And you do have examples of that. National Socialist Movement, the biggest story of my life was breaking that a FBI informant co-founded that. Well, that the co-founder was Robert Brannon, the FBI informant. Who was the other co-founder? Cliff Harrington, whose wife, Austin's gonna love this. Cliff Harrington's wife is started the Joy of Satan Club. And that's she's an avowed Satanist. And this is according to Bill White at first, but he confirmed this. Harrington confirmed this to me. It's like the Anton LaVey brand of Satanism was specifically what they practice. And so you do have the not a Christian Satan, but like a pagan Satan combining to form the NSM. So you definitely have a strong example there. So that there you go.
Real quick, Nazis came over to the U.S., make the CIA, and continue the same process domestically. I know you've covered a lot of Nazi stuff and then kind of connections, say, with like some, I don't know, was Sutter really like a Nazi of the Nazi aesthetic? Or, yeah, I believe he was as well. There might be connections you can make there between Gladio, CIA.
And that's the thing. Sutter started in the Aryan Nation. His dad is David Sutter, who he was hanging out with David Gleddy, and that's where David Gleddy forms the story. It was my understanding that the Sutters were Aryan Nation's Nazis and that Joshua Caleb somehow got into the David Myatt stuff later in the 2000s. But I don't know. I will say Sutter is the proof that PatCon never ended because he took down guys who were involved in the 90s. So like he's the continuation.
All right. Jesus. I also have someone asking what your elevator take is on OKC.
Botched sting operation.
There you go. That's the best. Yep. You haven't really covered the Falun Gong stuff, have you? I don't know if you have any thoughts on that.
Patrick McFarlane would be the guy for that.
Yep. That was the claim, though, that they were organ harvesting. It's possible, but that seemed to be disingenuous as far as Pat's reporting was concerned. Seemed that he was at least suggesting that that was the case.
Yeah, the sources were dubious. It was a bunch of CIA front nonprofits promoting it.
100%. Yeah.
Was the Epoch Times building set on fire in China? Someone says it's true. That it was set on fire in China as like an attack to silence them. I remember hearing a story about that in an ad they did. I don't know if that's something.
I don't think they have a presence in China.
Yeah, I don't know.
They've been attacked in the U.S. by Chinese operatives, according to them. And I think there's some truth to that. If you guys see the advertisements every Christmas time for like China before communism, that's the epic. You see them like everywhere in the country, like big billboards. You go into a restaurant, there's little flyers. It's for this play about China before communism. That's another Falun Gong Epic Times thing.
Yeah. I don't expect you either of you guys have any thoughts on this, but I just thought this was interesting. I don't know if it's true. This might be up your alley, Austin, to look into. I found this week the reason the Bohemian Grove guys worship an owl is because Rockefeller had an obsession with these Indians in Florida that sacrificed their firstborn in front of an owl. I don't know if that's true, but that'd be interesting. I wouldn't be surprised at all.
I thought it was just mainly the cremation of care, the Moloch, and the symbol of the owl. And it being involved with the satanic...
Isn't Moloch a bull, though?
Yeah, well, it's different forms as well. And you have to realize, like, it's a strange thing that as far as, like, whenever they're referencing the owl god Moloch, like, it's referenced as an owl. It's referenced as different entities. It's interesting because when you read like the Abrasax satanic cult of Belgium that's connected to the Dutroux network, right? They conduct this satanic ritual called the chase, and it's a sacrifice, and it's to the ancient pagan god Moloch, and it's a child sacrifice ritual, and it's basically they send them out, they send out dogs, and they send them out naked into the woods. And then it's this terrible, extraordinary, brutal, you know, ritual where they end up killing usually the child, which is like, I detail it in the Dutroux episode actually. But when you realize like the Abrasax cult is 100%.
Wait, Abraxas?
Well, they're that's
the Abraxas cult.
It's also Abrasax.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
It's crazy because they're also it's like similar entities, basically the same reference, but that you can if you look up Abraxas, it will say Abrasax as well. It's like, it's so again, they have dual references. They have interesting language that they use. Their occult sacrifices are very like, again, they use Moloch has layered references, right? And so again, it's represented in different forms. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know
and
if like, Ken's ever gone down the Belgian monster rabbit hole. If
I'm
not,
telling you,
like, what the fuck are you brother, talking about?
So in the, with the, like I've been going down some, I was reading, Eye of the Chicken Hawk, earlier, and it's one of the craziest books I've ever read in my life. And there's a reference to the Order of the Solar Temple deep within the book. And they go on to lay out this connection for Luc Jarret, a neo-Nazi Belgian Congo, literally tied in directly to one of the neo-Nazi paramilitary organizations that were a part of Belgian Gladio, that are directly tied to the Marc Dutroux human child trafficking operation. And so, and in the book, damn, they like lay the groundwork to this insane story of how two of Dutroux's victims were actually like Effie Lambrix and I forget the other girl's name, Anne Marshall, I think is her name. And they end up being murdered in the Dutroux scandal, right? And it turns out, man, like they are actually hypnotized at this club, and they are hypnotized in front of an audience for over 2 hours, right? In like the most insane, like it seems almost like a ritual in itself, right? It's absolutely crazy. And so they go into all this, you know, DID, trauma-based mind control. But the idea is that, and this guy, this Rosti Rostelli or something, was the hypnotist who put these girls in a trance in on stage for 2 hours, but the night they were abducted, and then inevitably wound up in Dutroux's, you know, it's just so crazy. And they wind up dead, and it's just absolutely tragic. But apparently they were on stage before an audience and in a complete dissociative state, right? Being entirely mind controlled the night they were abducted. And on the evening of the kidnapping, Anne and her girlfriend Effie Lambrix, who also murdered by Dutroux, had attended a Rostelli hypnosis show in Blankenberg on the coast in August 95. Father Marshall, I think is how you pronounce it, initially insisted on Rostelli coming forward as a witness, right? The guy who put them under hypnosis, because he thought the girls were lured by Dutroux under the influence of hypnosis. And so these statements were made by friends of Anne and Effia, and who were on holiday with the girls on the Belgian coast at the time of the kidnapping. And according to a friend who testified in court, Anne wouldn't have reacted this way normally if she were actually attacked, right? So clearly the hypnosis had an effect. She would never just go along with someone like Marc Dutroux, you know. And so it made the father, right, kind of strengthened his conviction that the girls must have been confused. It must have been a part. Put the two girls under hypnosis, and both were on stage in Blankenberg for almost 2 hours, like I said. But the similarly hypnotized friends say it took them hours to fully recover from the hypnosis. And so this performance was apparently recorded on video and described in a Dutch magazine article. And they were like critical of this hypnotist. And this is one of the craziest things that I've ever read, especially after knowing what happened to those girls and realizing what had happened to when Dutroux was arrested and they found the girls who had not yet been killed, who were in this covert, like, basement that, you know, was this secret, it was like behind this hidden wall. Like, it was so insane when you look at it. And they were entirely naked whenever they arrested Dutroux, when they found these girls. One was like cleaning the tiles on the floor. And then when they tried to like free her, right, and free these girls that were in this specially built cellar, They thanked Dutroux. This is according to Judge Conorat before he was removed from the case. It's really a twisted form of, like, it's just, it's completely insane the level of Belgian high society who is connected to this and why they would be able to remove a prosecutor, remove a judge. The False Memory Syndrome Foundation inserts themselves into the case to completely undermine the credibility of Regina Louf, one of the ex-victims. And the ex-witness testimony and all of that that WikiLeaks had revealed at this time, the ex-dossier is what it was called. And, you know, the ex-dossier, it revealed that Dutroux hypnotized a girl he raped in 94. And when they arrested him, they found equipment for hypnotizing someone with all this literature about it. And so they called it hypnosis equipment. And it was seized from the house where he kept Anne Markle and Effie Lambrix for 2 weeks prior to their murder, chained up while they're being brutally raped. It's terrible, man. And so to finish this really quickly, I'm sorry. But it's just absolutely crazy, man. I was reading this, and I couldn't believe that once again I wander into the Belgian network, into the Gladio Belgian network, with these neo-Nazi paramilitary organizations training up people in the New Westland Post and all of this that are committing bombings at grocery stores and stuff just to sow utter chaos in Belgian society, over, you know, use it as a pretext to overthrow a government at the time. So, you know, completely crazy what was actually happening. But when these two girls were freed, though, from the basement, they had been conditioned entirely to believe that Dutroux was their protector, right? Like, that alone, the Belgian investigating judge who ordered Mark Dutroux's arrest in August 96, he described how these two young girls hid from their rescuers and embraced their torturer when they were freed. When Dutroux escorted police to the specially built cellar where Sabine and Letitia were held, they didn't want to come out, and they tried to hide from their rescuers, according to Conorat. They thanked Dutroux. It was absolutely terrible. They kissed him.
Yeah.
That shows how much he had conditioned them, he said. That's just so insane to me,
fucked
man.
Up shit. Fun fact, yeah. David Ferry was really big into fucking hypnotism, too.
Sorry. Yes, dude. He was hypnotizing Lee Harvey Oswald and all the members of the Louisiana CAP, and then he was raping them. Like, that was happening, dude. You know, at least according to certain people. And I believe the story, but allegedly. You know what I mean?
We just threw a lot at you, Ken.
I dipped my toe into that stuff when I was doing, like, the 764 reporting earlier this year with BX.
Yeah.
And it is, like, it's important. It's obviously crucially important to understanding how shit works. But it just, like, it puts me in a dark space. I think motor outlaw bikers and renegade bomb makers is just, like, it's fun. It's fun for me.
Brother.
More lighthearted.
This shit isn't fun. So, like, I'm just going to report on what I like.
Yeah, wait till you start digging deep. You're already at that angle, at the angle of the bikers. That's where.
That's the bikers.
That's where you get to dark shit.
Oh,
that's where
Jesus,
you're
going
to run into Satanism and stuff. Because you've been covering this stuff, Austin, recently. I mean, I don't know if these biker gangs intermingle, but that was at one point with the Satanist groups, the claim was that they were utilizing the biker groups as kind of like protection. Almost their own little mafia of sorts.
Exactly
so,
what they were doing.
You may inadvertently end up back at Satanism as all routes lead to.
Like I said, Joshua Caleb Sutter was involved with Primitive Affliction in this biker front group. So there's already the Satanist connection there.
Mm-hmm.
Which I do think that's probably, we're talking about Satanists. Someone asked, when you say Satanist, do you mean people actually practice it or like Satan acting through them? Now, this is kind of a complicated question because there are dimensions to what you mean when you say Satanist. I'm not a woo-woo guy. I'm not religious at all. I'm an agnostic atheist. So, like, when I say Satanist, I mean these people that have dark beliefs. It's kind of very vague. I mean, whether they're worshiping Moloch or Minerva or whoever the fuck, whatever deity they're worship, Ra, I don't fucking care. It's more like is it dark? Are they doing weird, dark, fucked up shit? I mean, I guess theoretically you can do Satanism without hurting people or children or whatever, but that's like a common trope when we're talking about this. At least I am when I'm talking about these type of Satanists. It usually comes down to, I mean, really just kind of evil. And the question is, do you mean people who actually practice it or Satan acting through them? I mean, I guess if I was a religious person, I'd say that Satan acting through them, because really the people we're talking about, I don't really feel like there's much, really, it's just evil, the kind of shit they're doing. And I don't know. When you get into this realm, this is where I talk about we're getting into the veil, where like intel and this weird Satanism component start to blend, and you're like, you don't know which is which. Like, is it just because they're just evil? Is it like the tweet that's like, it's not complicated, they just want to diddle your kids or whatever, you know, the point the sign thing? Like, I don't really know. This is where you really start scratching your head and you're like, dude, is this really all just set up by elites to fucking, you know, fucking diddle our kids and fucking extract evil energy or whatever the fuck they're doing, they think they're doing, whether their God is real or not? I don't know. I mean, I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on, like, it's an interesting thing because I do think when a lot of us bring up this, immediately the knee-jerk reaction is, oh, satanic panic. And you're like, almost like it's like this religious, you know, reaction. And that's not me at all. I'm not like, oh my God, like these are Satanists and I worship Jesus. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but it's just like, I'm just like, yo, I'm seeing signs of fucking weird sexual ritualistic abuse going on, a lot of times concerning children with connections to intelligence agencies, and I'm fucking concerned. And I guess we're going to call this Satanism, you know? I don't really get, like, people get caught up on the terminology. I don't know if you guys have any thoughts on it at all. I mean, what do you mean when you say Satanists, Ken?
I know, I guess I've never read the literature, but I've heard people describe, like, oh, it's the, you know, just a very individualistic, turning yourself into God. You are the center of the universe, and you got to free yourself of all these, you know, bullshit rules and boundaries. Like, you are, you know, what you make yourself. So I guess that's what I understand it. As far as like whether it's Satan acting through people or they're practicing Satanism. I mean, I think a lot of the people I deal with are LARPers. Like these 7-6-4 kids are LARPing, but at what point does a LARP become real? I mean, when we talk about like Patriot Front or something, if you're LARP, like eventually you really are going to be storming the Capitol. Like, so yeah, Satan, not good. He's the bad guy in the Bible. So that's stay away.
I mean, on your point though, with the ideology, I do want to make a distinction, because this is, I think, where people do go to the reflexive satanic panic, because there is a component of Satanism that I do think is, because I used to be the Reddit atheist type, and so I'd encountered these people. I always thought this was kind of gay, to be honest. The people who do the like that type of Satanism, where it's like literally just a replacement for church, it's community. Most of them are just like at this level of Satanism or whatever, or this, you know, this interpretation of the word Satanism, it is like these people just have a credo. If you look at it, it's actually really not that bad. It's pretty standard, like don't hurt people type shit. And they're mostly just people who like to irritate religious people and then throw it back in their face at like, look what a good moral system we have. And calling themselves Satanists is just more or less an affront to religious people because they have some sort of deep inborn hatred to them or whatever. Their mom didn't say they love them enough and they're Christian. I don't know.
And they basically are trolling Christians at that point.
Now, I see that as separate to what we're talking about when we talk about Satanists.
Definitely.
Because it's kind of this all-encompassing term. And like those dorks that do that, I mean, if anything, they're more just a distraction. I mean, if you were talking about that specifically, I'm like, okay, well, we're just consider that a separate thing, because I don't really feel like they really play a part. Now, if you are looking to the higher levels of that type of Satanism, and you get into like the people like the Vey and shit like that, then now it gets into real, like something else is going on other than what they profess it to be at that point, I think.
Exactly.
If you look at LaVey's history. Ken, do you have any hot takes on Assange? I don't know if you've really gone too deep down the Assange rabbit hole. I know there's some weird stuff with his past and stuff a lot of people like to bring up. I don't know. I've never really dug in too deep of it. I mean,
yeah, I've heard that in passing reference, but I know free Assange. That's my stance. Oh, yeah. It's a controversial stance, but
definitely.
Yeah. Didn't the few girls die because this was on the Belgian monster, because he was in jail and they didn't get food or water? Wasn't there survivors?
Oh, yeah. There was a 3 and a 4-year-old. Yeah.
Yeah. That's awful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right.
But then there was also alternative stories claiming that those girls actually didn't die of starvation. And there were other people who had access to the property throughout the time of his incarceration. And that actually, even though the story of his wife, who was allegedly involved with the network and was instructed to feed the children and later claimed that she was too scared to go down there and feed the children, even though she had been heavily involved within the abduction of other children all throughout this process. It turns out that it's very possible that those two young girls were actually spotted at one of these highfalutin clubs where, like, Michel Nihoul, who's actually the beast of Belgium, the monster of Belgium, he calls himself, that he will never be held accountable. He says it out loud to, you know, journalists, right? Like, he died a free man in like 2019. And he's who Marc Dutroux was abducting those girls for. There was a much broader network at play, and one of Nihoul's properties, allegedly those two girls, during the course of Dutroux's incarceration, while they allegedly starved to death, were potentially witnessed being abused at one of those other properties by other individuals who had access to Dutroux's place. So, yeah, I think there's always more to the story. There seems to be a lot more details that if you just keep prying, you're going to reveal them to yourself, like, certainly. And as far as the Moloch, though, I will say that Moloch, they are pronounced differently. There's an association with Baal as well. And I think that like these pagan deities, right? And it's referenced as like a bull-headed idol as well as an owl-like deity. And so it's like there are like different depictions, you know, and I'm not necessarily, I don't fully understand exactly what each of them represent. And, you know, I couldn't exactly explain it at this moment, but I definitely believe that there's something as far as something worth understanding when it comes to the fact that individuals believe this, though. They, you know what I mean? And like, as far as they practice this ideology, this doctrine, they live their life by it. Either they've been convinced and indoctrinated, or they have an agenda. They want to control people, manipulate. I'm not entirely certain. You know, I think there's different layers to that.
Did this shit go on back in like the 19th century and 18th century, or there's like satanic cults, like more recent.
Well, knowledge. Blood sacrifice certainly has been happening for a long time, and
like
human
at the high levels of like the monarchies and stuff, or their conspiracies, or
yeah, there's definitely like at least at the very least secret societies who perform these rituals, and there seems to be a sadistic level to the rituals.
Well, you had the Belgium Illuminati, like right off the bat, yeah. Like once again, still in Belgium. So I mean, I don't know if they specifically were saying that.
Baron, they've been voicing.
They were tied in, I believe, with the God, was it Zabdi Zevi? I forget, or was it the Frank character later? I forget. There was two different people when it came to Sabbateanism, and they were tied into the like kind of the founding of the Illuminati. And I mean, if you're gonna make that connection, and then also what the Illuminati is, the Sabbateans were doing was this weird messianic Judaic movement that inverted the law in essentially kind of what was good becomes bad and what's bad becomes good. So they were all about like transgressing to bring on a new age, which is weirdly like a common trope among like the satanic fucking cults. Like if you look at like 09A, it's like, yeah, kind of bringing on a new age.
Accelerationism.
And that's exactly the same thing that Sabbateanism was about, that their ideas on the messianic age has started and now we need to carry on by like essentially sinning. Now that the Messiah has come, it inverted the law, and this will bring on the Messiah or whatever event, and this will like shift a new age of peace where they have whatever the fuck their thing is they want. And they were tied in. So obviously, if what is bad is good and good is bad, the big thing the Sabbateans were accused of was like a lot of the blood libel stuff from back in the day. They kind of attributed that. And I think there's probably truth to that. So I'm surprised that people don't point to this more when blood libel comes up, be like, that's their fault, not ours. Yeah, so there was a lot of like weird stuff about like the sacrificing of children or incest and all sorts of like the stuff that you typically wouldn't consider to be proper things to do in a religious context. That then became, oh no, now this is a proper thing to do because we're trying to bring on a new age. So, but it was just kind of like an acceleration of, in like in a moral type sense, an accelerationist mindset. They were also about infiltrating other religions and groups too. So, under, you know, deception, because their ultimate goal was advancing theirs. So
yeah, it was just trying to get a sense for how much of this stuff is astroturf or just ingrained in certain people's biology. Because, you know, you look at like a spike in serial killers in the 80s, that looks astroturf, obviously, probably to all of us, but. Yeah, I was just trying to get a sense of that. It's an interesting answer.
I mean, I think it's one of those things, too, where you can always keep going down the rabbit hole and finding something else that connects to it. I guess while we're still on the Satanism stuff, someone brought up Aquino. I think I lost the chat. I'm just, when are we going to get to Michael Aquino? He's a way of popping up in many things. I don't know if you've ever gone down that rabbit hole, if any of your work has brought you to Aquino. It seems to be a lot of roads lead to Aquino. I don't know, any thoughts? It just, or how has it tied into your work, maybe, in any way?
I don't know much about him, but I broke the FBI released his file and I just saw it sitting up on the FBI's website. So I did like a story, FBI releases file on Aquino. It was just about, they were talking about him complaining about the false allegations. That's like what the internal FBI reports were. It's not the most interesting story. You're not going to find like these hidden gems on the FBI's website, but I did break that story for whatever that's worth.
Well, I think we're going to go ahead and get out of here, but I did, this was an interesting stream of thought from this buddy here. We had a Supreme Court Justice who was a Frankist Sabbatean, Louis Brande, and he has connections to the Franklin scandal. I'd be interested if someone look into that. I didn't even know the Sabbateans were really had any sort of presence in any modern day sense. I thought that was like literally like over 100 years ago type stuff. But it just kind of like if you're looking into the secret societies and how they influence each other, that's kind of an interesting thing to bring up. But yeah, either way, I think we're at a good spot now. Adam put in the chat, OKC, our producer said, OKC was where Programmed to Kill and PatCon intersect. I think you might have something there. Ken, let our people know. I mean, if you have any of your final thoughts on anything we've talked about today or anything you have coming up, or you know, also just promote, you know, where people can find your work at and that kind of stuff.
Well, I could talk about David Gleddy for another 2 hours, I think I got some big stuff coming down the pipeline, so hopefully we'll return to this. And yeah, Headline USA, Libertarian Institute at Twitter, JD_cashless, and yeah, thanks again.
Awesome. Austin?
All right, man. Ken, it's been awesome, brother. It's good to meet you for sure. Again, thank you, man, for coming on, and for that dude. There is an Aquino reference to that David Myatt, by the way, and I found that hilarious. Like, as far as in that same piece by this, like, it's like some German language internet media outlet, and it's like dubbed conspiracy theorist. You know what I mean? Like, as far as so that's my source for this, but it's pretty amazing as far as like as just the connection in general, and it is like translated from German, and it says that while Myatt's involvement with Column 88 in the 1970s and 1980s is documented in his autobiography by academics and in other articles, this conspiracy theorist goes on to suggest a connection between Myatt and Michael Aquino of the Temple of Set.
And, well, didn't they like correspond or something? I think they used to argue about satanic philosophy or some bullshit.
Right.
So they were definitely acquainted.
Yeah. Right. I just think it's hilarious that he comes up in every damn thing that I read about. It's just ridiculous to me. But so anyway, you guys can find me at The Underclass Pod on Twitter, at The Underclass Podcast on Instagram. I should have my new solo episode done at least by the end of the week, which should be, you know, basically entirely involved with the Order of the Solar Temple and how it has like Gladio connections. And once again, the cult is not what it seems. And it seems to be propped up by a hidden hand. But anyway, it's been great, Ken. Nice to meet you, brother.
Yes, sir.
Well, hell yeah. Everyone pop in next week. Well, we'll do this again at Tuesday at 9:30. I don't think we're having any schedule change coming up. Pop in, call in, be in the chat. I do want to give a shout out to my sponsors real quick who's helped me do what I do at patreon.com. SnowyJose2020. My co-host on Tower Gang at Tower Gang Toad. Also have at Abrogate D's and at ZOVERACK. At underscore Infinite Zeal and Jacob Daniel, the Biblical Anarchy Podcast. Then also my buddy Tim Tuttle at Jolly on Klebold. And then my buddy Will Bell, who makes this delicious rabbit eye blueberry wine. Go check that out. Like, share, subscribe, comment, share this around, make edits, do whatever. Get this out there, more people can see it. Definitely go check out the Gleddy interview. Share that around, because that's some bombshell stuff. But with that, we are out.
Baseball fans, BetMGM is giving you the chance to win a prize every day during the baseball season. Step into the batter's box for BetMGM's Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. Pick any area of the strike zone and take your best swing. If you get a single, double, triple, or home run, you'll receive a prize. Smash a home run to collect a bonus bet on us. Just log into your BetMGM sports account to get started. Then visit your promotion section to access the Swing for the Fences free-to-play game. You'll score a prize if you hit a single, double, triple, or home run. There's nothing more exciting than going yard, so swing for the fences with the king of sportsbooks. BetMGM and GameSense remind you to play responsibly. Must be 21 plus and present in Ohio, subject to eligibility requirements. Rewards vary depending on the market and expire 24 hours from issuance. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER in partnership with MGM Northfield Park.